Talk given Sunday, 7th July, 1974. The two interlinked subjects, termed karma and rebirth, have a very long history. These two doctrines are fundamental to the religions of India. With the exception of Zarathustrianism. But the other main religions of India all accept karma and rebirth. They are doctrines which are not part of the common teaching. These doctrines are not common to the religions which sprang in Western Asia, Judaism, Christianity, and Islam. Now, this is perhaps the first important consideration. Three great world religions have flourished for several thousand years without the doctrines of karma and rebirth. If karma and rebirth, as presented in India, I specially emphasize as presented, the form in which they are presented in India, were indispensable fundamental truths corresponding to reality, then it is a bit difficult to understand how three great world religions have got along extremely well without those two doctrines. Bear in mind that all the great religions have certain things in common. The acceptance of transcendence, for instance. All the religions have the idea of God. Buddhism does not have the idea of a creator God as of supreme importance. Buddhism accepts the gods as such, but it has no supreme individual entity or being called God in it. But Buddhism unequivocally asserts transcendence. The Buddha says again and again, repeatedly, there is a world beyond. And he speaks of that state which is the end of all ill. And if you look carefully into his statements with regard to that condition, the end of all ill, you will see that it is a very positive assertion of the reality of transcendence as such, and that it is the ultimate good and the supreme good. So you see, the whole idea of transcendence or an ultimate reality as such, in which is subsumed all the totality which comes into being, grows and passes away, is fundamental to all the great religions of the world. But where karma and rebirth are concerned, they are not fundamental doctrines for at least three of the world's great religions. They are not present in any form whatever. That is to say, in the shape in which India accepts them, the reincarnational form. This is important to bear in mind. Let us look carefully into what is the meaning of the word karma, first and foremost. It is usually understood popularly, as a sort of a law of causality. Here are so many causes, and there are the effects. And it is accepted that the law of causality is immutable, that all the causes must of necessity produce effects, and those effects come back to you, the individual entity, the individual person. This is the assumption which has to be challenged. And if you look deeply into it, you will see that it doesn't hold water. It cannot hold water. This is where the great difficulty comes. This is why Brahmanism, which precedes modern Hinduism, which precedes the age of the Buddha, Brahmanism accepted the idea of an immortal entity, which was the individual human being. Brahmanism accepted it, but the deepest teachings of the Upanishads do not have it. You will find that they are that some translations, a great many translations of the Upanishads, mislead the reader. In the Rig Veda, which is the origin of the entire Vedic teaching and tradition, there is not the slightest mention of reincarnation. That's very, very significant, because the Rig Veda is the very root of the whole of the Brahmanical Hindu teaching as such. Now, this assumption of the individual entity crept in, because, for one thing, it was too difficult for the masses to enter into such deep conceptions and philosophy. Go back to the origin of the idea, of those ideas which paved the way for the theory of the reincarnation of an individual entity. Long before the Aryan-speaking peoples entered India and settled there, bringing the Rig Veda with them, long before them, quite 4 or 5,000 years at least, somewhere near 7,000 years ago, the Negrito and Proto-Australoid inhabitants of India, who had spread right over the whole subcontinent, conceived of what they call soul matter, of an indestructible, generalized life principle, that at the death of the person, this entered into the soil, and through the soil came up in plants and other animals. If a pregnant woman ate of that plant or animal, that life principle entered into her, and the child was quickened and was born, and so forth. This was the vague sort of generalized primitive feeling which those peoples had. But this, you can see, paved the way for the more individualistic conception of the individual entity who persisted through time. I have to be very brief with it, otherwise we can go on till midnight on this topic. When the Rig Vedic peoples established themselves in power in India and established kingdoms over the whole of northern India, several great kingdoms arose, each roughly the size of Britain, because India is not a small country, as you know. They were in the minority. The others were in the majority. The influence of these Rig Vedic Aryan-speaking peoples, who settled in the whole and spread right across the whole of the Indo-Gangetic plain, were very good organizers. They were an extremely tolerant people. They were a race of poets too. And coming as they did from the harsh steppe lands of Central Asia, here they found a land flowing with milk and honey, relatively speaking, and they wished to establish and maintain great social orders. Now their task was to reconcile themselves as a ruling class with the conquered inhabitants. Before they came, in the very first instance, with the Negritos and Proto-Australoids, there were only village settlements which had spread through the whole subcontinent. Later on, with the influx of people from Armenia and Chaldea, the Euphrates-Tigris region, Ur, Eridu, Larsa, Lagash, all those places, those people came along, settled down, and brought with them the arts and crafts of a civilized order, because they were highly civilized people compared with the aboriginals of India. So they brought arts and crafts, music, mathematics, astronomy, and of course they were great city builders. They built really wonderful cities in those days, including fine drainage systems. Modern borough councils might take a leaf out of their notebooks as to how they managed their affairs in those days. And they had more or less a republican order as such. So, upon this population, this mixed population of the vast number of the aboriginals and these people who came from the riverine region, the Euphrates-Tigris region, who built the city-states, came the Rig Vedic Indo-Aryans. They came armed with horse and sword, and they had the advantage over these people who did not have the iron sword with them. They had bronze swords only, and they had no horses. They hadn't learned to be riders and tame horses, you see. So they were conquered with probably successive infiltrations from the northwest across the mountains. Now, when the Rig Vedic Aryans, with their skill as organizers and with their tolerance, wanted to conciliate these people, they said, "We are the children of Brahma. The Brahman is born from his mouth, and the ruling caste, the warrior caste, is born of his arms. You who are settled cultivators and workers are born of his belly and his feet. Now, it is one Brahma who is our supreme father and origin. You perform your duties in the name of that Brahma, we will perform our duties. We will protect you, look after you, and so forth and so forth." All right, so the kingdoms grew up. Then, naturally, these people, the civilized people from the Mesopotamian region, who had great intellects amongst them, began to question these Brahmins. "Where is the justice in this sort of thing? Why should we be conquered by you, etc., etc.?" That was one question. And of course, there were the usual questions. If there is a Brahma, a god who looks after all things and ordains things and so forth, why is this man born lame or blind or miserable, poor, in difficulties, and that man thus and thus and thus? Now, remember that already the Proto-Australoids and Negritos had these vague primitive ideas of an indestructible soul substance which entered the soil, came into plants, and then came out as fresh human beings. So the Brahmins, who were also very astute-minded, seized upon this idea and said, "Look, you existed in the past. And those who did not live the good life, did not fulfill their duties, you see, come back into life again and have to pay the penalty for it. For whatever good they did, they will have good consequences. For whatever wrong they did, they will have ill consequences." And this coupled with various petty conceptions, produced the individual reincarnating entity, later on, of course, expanded metaphysically and philosophically into the immortal soul and all the rest of it. And the feeling of the unity of the one total reality, which is the whole universe, became subservient to this split in conception. The individual persisting entity as such. And so the concept of reincarnation, of rebirth, came into being. In Greece, as you know, they had various concepts. That was rather later on. They had what they called transmigration, metempsychosis, metensomatosis, palingenesis, various terms like that, all of which have quite specific and very interesting meanings for the metaphysician and philosopher. They are undoubtedly very interesting, but they are all speculative philosophy based upon the fundamental assumption of a permanent entity. And yet, Greece itself, for example, with people like Parmenides, Heraclitus, and all those great Greek philosophers, they were aware that change, constant change, is one of the fundamental facts of existence. There is no such thing as permanence anywhere. And yet they postulated a permanent entity where the human being was concerned. The same in India. Now, consider carefully. We have to just look into our own nature. How easily we say, oh, I can't bear to think of being annihilated, of being snuffed out of existence. All right, I can't bear to think of it. That is a true statement. But does that, therefore, mean that what I can bear to think of is the truth, and this is not the truth? What is the fact? Are we concerned with truth, or are we concerned with our petty little reactions out of our fears and ignorance, and above all, our egoism, which makes us cling to ourself, the self that we imagine that we know? This self is to be extended in perpetuity through all time. All right, Torquemada, Hitler are being extended in perpetuity through all time. How do you like it? Now, you see, we have to be absolutely genuine and honest in our examination of all this. Examine all the fundamental assumptions and preconceptions, and you will find that there is not a single one of them which has any warrant whatsoever in truth, in reality. So this is how this doctrine came to stay, in the reincarnational form. Now let us look at another aspect of it. Our consciousness functions through the instrumentality of our sense functioning and our faculty of speech, which enables us to synthesize our different sense impressions into coherent mental patterns, logical mental patterns, all within a limited context. This is how our consciousness normally functions. But there are those states of awareness, the deep states, which function differently. How and why? What we call the mind, what we know of our own mind and mental processes, is only a fragment of the whole reality of mind. All of us human beings, ever since we came on the globe, what is it, 3-4 million years ago or whatever it is, we have been blasted with an extraordinary self-conceit, I know. If there is anything, any one thing that I personally know, it is the fact that I do not know. When, in those wonderful occasions, you are rapt beyond the senses, and it seems as if you are in creative interplay with the eternal, you suddenly wake up in those states to the fact that this which you call mind and knowledge here is nothing at all besides that state. That there are profundities of mind which will probably take hundreds of thousands of years to unfold through the human race. And in those states of awareness, you experience existence, the totality of existence, in a totally different way. We experience existence and the world in terms of separate particular objects and persons and events and conditions and so forth. That is how we experience the world now. In terms of separation, the intellect and the discriminative consciousness which we use splits the world into its particulars. They are like prisms which split up the white light into several colors. And all we know of is the several colors and not the white light, which is the integration of the whole thing. We don't know it. We don't know universality in consciousness. We only use the word universe, but in our inner consciousness, we are not at home with the universality of the universe. We are at home in our inner consciousness, in the condition in which we are, in terms of separation, of the breakup of the universe. This is the meaning of the sin of Adam, the fallen state. All right. Now, in those other states of consciousness, you experience reality in its wholeness. And experiencing reality in its wholeness, you discover one extraordinary thing. That there is no language, no human language yet invented, which can possibly express that wholeness. There is no language. There are just a few words in all languages which can deny the not wholeness. Words like infinity, absolute, eternal, transcendent, God, Brahman, Atma, immortality. These are words which contradict our experience limited to particulars and finitude in terms of space, time, matter, causation, etc. But those words have no power within the inner depths of our minds. They are only surface things which we utilize. That is one thing we discover then in those deep states, that there is no language to express this. And there is another thing. Now this you must really get hold of. Listen very carefully. The manifested universe is a perpetually living thing. There is no such thing as dead matter. Even modern science has now, in the last 15 years only, produced a concept of matter which is in complete harmony with the old concept from India, that the entire universe is a living universe. Now the characteristic of the living is action, movement. Put it in its most scientific form, vibration. It is a vibrating. Now don't think in terms of separate particles vibrating. This is a vibration of that reality which we name the universe, the world. And we are aware of it only through the extraordinarily poor media of our sense perceptions and functions and our speech faculty. in those deep states of consciousness, you get into tune with that vibration of the entire universe. Not only the what we commonly call the material universe, but the totality of existence. It is because of this fact that I have always used the phrase one total reality. You get into rhythm with it. We cannot, as we are, vibrate at the same rate as that totality vibrates. That vibration of that totality is creative action of transcendent energy in eternity. That vibration is creative action of transcendent energy in eternity. It is right beyond anything that you and I experience. In the ordinary way, we certainly experience nothing of it. We are enclosed within the sphere of death, mortality. Everything comes to the end. And death for us means the complete disruption, the change which is totally irreversible. That is how we are conscious of death, of the nature of death. But when in those deep states you vibrate, those very deep states, right beyond mind and discursive thought, concepts, ideas, etc., etc., or any sort of feelings, don't deceive yourself that you ever experienced it. When you vibrate in tune with that, then you vibrate at a lower level, but yet you are in tune. It is like, say, playing the bottom C of the piano, which has 24, let us say for convenience, 24 vibrations per second. You and I can vibrate at our supreme level at 24 vibrations per second. And take the top C or go several octaves higher is the enormous rate of vibration of the same note. That's the important point. It's the same note. You see? Now, coming back to ordinary consciousness, the ordinary activity of the thinking process, the imaginative process, and your speech faculty comes into action again. When you experience those states, an impress is made upon your brain, your physical brain. You may never, on the return, be able to have a thought and speech activity start up in your brain, which will give form and shape to this impress on the brain. You may never, you may go right to the end of your days and just nothing can be said about it. But if you have, you're gifted that way, call it the grace of God if you like. If you're gifted that way, it may sometimes take form and shape in terms of thought and speech. You see? Now, how to express the nature of this creative activity in eternity by transcendent energy? How to express it? Now, it was in trying to express this that the old people, unfortunately, could not get beyond their mental conditioning, which made them think in terms of continuity, in the sense in which a river is a continuous mass of water flowing past. They couldn't get rid of that. They had no sense of what we call the discontinuous pulse of the action of energy. They had no such sense at all. Not even the Buddha. And he went far enough. Or those like Yajnavalkya and the others who talked of Brahman. All honor to them that they were able to state what they did state. Now, this sense of continuity is the mistake in the sense of a river flowing past, the same water idea. Every single pulse of this creative activity produces a totally new universe every split second. It's totally new. It is never a repetitive creative action. Because repetition is not creation. Supposing you were to just repeat one note on the piano all the time. Are you composing music? Not at all. It is not repetitive. It is everlastingly new. It is not a reshuffling of old material. Do remember that. It is totally new. It's new with a newness that the human brain, at least my brain, simply cannot formulate. I only state this very, very positively. Don't question me why. You look into your own minds and hearts and see if you can find out. But this is the crux of the matter. It is non-repetitive. It is entirely new. But it is new in the sense that it is a transmutation, not just an ordinary transformation, which is changing the old material. It is a transmutation, get that very clearly, of the old. It's new in that sense. Now, have you got the basic concept clearly? This was inexpressible in the old days. So they had to tie it up with the thread of continuity. But then if you tie it up with the thread of continuity, what can continue but an immortal entity? There's no such thing. So you see, the reincarnational picture came about because of their incapacity to see that there is no continuity in our sense mind meaning of the word continuity. This transmutation takes place with every pulse of creation, which is entirely new, non-repetitive. Our minds, our consciousness, discriminative consciousness that we have, is such a sluggard, that we are more sluggish than the jolly old dinosaur who, if a mouse bit his tail, about 3 months later, the impulse would reach his brain and he'd know what had happened. We are far more sluggish than that, where this matter is concerned. You see? So this idea of rebirth as we have it, the form in which we have it, is, I say categorically and positively, is a misconception. It's a misleading form. And it has unfortunate results, therefore, upon the way we behave and live in life. We are insensitive to the urgency of the immediate moment. The immediate moment is lost where creativeness is concerned for us. Because we are content to be stuck in this mire of sluggishness. Now, please note, I am not denying the underlying reality, the truth, which unfortunately got presented in this mistaken form. The underlying reality is this creative action in eternity by transcendent energy. That is the underlying reality. And those who experience that through purification, through the discipline of the religious life, through yoga, you use whatever words you like, you see, who entered that state of consciousness and realized it, could only say that this is utterly blissful, And it is blissful in the sense that it is totally beyond all sensational pleasure or excitement or delight. It has no relationship with anything that we know of and understand in the sphere of ambivalence, of duality, because they are everlastingly conflicting opposites. They are conflicting opposites because we are conscious of them as separate entities as such. This is pleasure, that is pain. But in terms of the totality, there is the organic, actual, integrated wholeness, which is the holiness of everything. Now, this creative action of transcendent energy in eternity is the meaning of the word karma. If you get this, you can throw aside all the tomes that you have read about karma for good and start afresh. All these ideas about cause and effect are such misleading concepts. And it won't be very long before causality is altogether thrown out of man's thinking, thanks to science, principally. Science and, I should say, mathematics, even more than science, because mathematics is the original source, so to say, by which people are beginning to understand that where creative activity is concerned, causality does not hold. Causality in classical mechanics is fast fading away, and certainly where investigation into the realm of the infinitely small is concerned, causality just doesn't hold at all. You see? So all those conceptions, and especially this putrid concept of retribution. You did something wrong in the past, and therefore now you are receiving your dole for it in terms of suffering or punishment or whatever it is. That's utter nonsense. And its counterpart, you did something good in the past, and therefore now you are having a happy time, a good time, and all the rest of it. Rubbish! If the sinless one, the Son of God himself, suffered death on the cross, what was that the retribution of? You see? In analyzing all this for yourselves, look very, very deeply into all the misconceptions, the conditioning of your own mind, all the preconceptions, the assumptions, the prejudices, the biases, which have no warrant in truth whatsoever. Examine them all. But don't say, oh, I was so convinced by what Firoz Mehta said that I threw them all out of the window. You cannot throw them out of the window. You only deceive yourself if you do. Because they are part and parcel of the actual substance of your psyche. All your beliefs, your ideas, your convictions are your psyche. You can't throw them out. I might as well say, I don't like my nose, I'll throw it out of the window. Can't. You see? You can transform them all by intelligence. The intelligence which is not dependent for its functioning upon any premises whatsoever. And this is another profound power of the mind which you realize if and when you enter the deep states of consciousness. That the mind, the nature of the mind, is knowledge itself. The nature of intelligence is perception itself. It is not an intelligence which is performing an act of perception with respect to another thing. This is the extraordinary part of it. And this is where we must take off our hats to those old people in India who have expounded this in the most marvelous manner, despite their limitations and their difficulties for exposition. It is really quite remarkable what they have done. And the Upanishads are the cream of that That is the secret of their survival. If you read the Upanishads, the actual original texts, there are 108 Upanishads. You read the actual original texts, most of them read like gibberish, downright gibberish. But once you've got the key and the understanding, gradually the whole thing comes to life and meaning. And so you will see that all the time through the centuries, and this is unavoidable, we are what we are, this is how we are constituted, only thus far have we gone in knowledge of the nature of things, therefore we cannot help formulating these doctrines. But the time comes when we can get right across them, right over them, transcend them, and the formulation changes. That is why I said, the underlying truth behind the doctrines of karma and reincarnation are reality itself. But as formulated in karma and rebirth, no, in the ordinary way, they are false. There is no such thing as the perpetuation of the ego sense, the I am I sense. The I am I sense is a fiction manufactured by the ignorant mind, the mind which is in fear. Do remember that. And this longing for perpetuity, this longing for a reward, is the self-centeredness in us. Look, do you really think that the universe cares two hoots about me? How could the poor universe care about me? Hasn't it got quite enough on its plate to deal with? 2,000 million galaxies, each consisting of 100,000 million stars, etc., etc., to deal with. It's got its timetable full. Why should it be bothered? How could it possibly be bothered about me? And the perpetuity of me, and doling out to me my wages, whether of sin or of good deeds. God, let me not be so utterly stupid as to think and feel in those terms. This, which is me, which is any person, is part of the total universal process. And it is the universal process which just goes on. And that is the one and only immortal, because it never began. It never can die. It is beyond time. It is other than space. So you see, once you really begin to see this, become conscious of it, become aware of it, transcend all the limitations of your logical intellectual processes and so on, then you have freedom of mind. You have peace of mind. Your heart is at rest. And the main reason why your heart is at rest is that you have ceased to care about the wrong things. What you now care about is the transcendent truth, the reality, the entire universal process. You don't care about yourself. You see, it has to happen naturally, spontaneously, through vision and understanding. But because the thousands who are rather poor in their mental powers, but have a religious feeling, and they are taught that it is sinful to be selfish, and it is religious and good to be unselfish, they repress themselves and create more trouble and harm than the ordinary wine women singing fellow who goes to the pub and enjoys himself. Approving what I said. So now, not by repression, but by understanding. Really understand, and be patient. Don't get worried and upset because you don't understand at once. And there isn't time. I have only so many more years to live, or this, that, and the other. Good gracious, enlightenment comes like that, in a flash. It comes at the critical point of endeavor through time. That is where time and eternity meet, at that critical point. And then, when the thing happens, the whole of the past, in time, the pleasures and pains, the joys and the sorrows, the successes and the failures, the stupidities and the visions, they all vanish into nothing. It is at this moment that you get a shadow of the experiencing of that creative activity of transcendent energy throughout eternity. You get a shadow of it. But it is you who realize the state of freedom, which means actually, I can put it in a better form verbally, that state of freedom is manifest through you. And the freedom does not belong to me or to you or to any individual, but it is characteristic of the totality of existence. Bliss, truth, freedom, love, wisdom, beauty, everything is characteristic of the totality of existence. It comes to fruition through you like beauty, wonderful beauty, comes into manifestation through the flower. The whole tree is not the flower, it's just the flower. Now, the procedure of meditation then, which ties up with understanding deep things like this. Several of you have heard this before, but I'll recapitulate very briefly because it's such a vast field. There are three main aspects to meditation. One is the meditation that goes on all 24 hours of the day, non-stop. And that is constant mindfulness. To be aware of all that the senses convey to you, and which is more important, to be clearly conscious of and aware of the reactions out of your own brain, out of your own mind, to those sense impressions. We all know how the same sense impression receives different reactions from different people, because they are conditioning, they are particular misconceptions and all the rest of it are different. So the response is different. And you will find how the self-sense, the sense in us which wants to draw the whole world to ourselves and possess it, is at play in all this. And it manifests as greed, violence, ambition, the passion to attain, to achieve, to express, to produce marvelous poetry or art or philosophy or science or conquer those of the lesser breeds and all the rest of the claptrap. All that rubbish will come up. Watch your reactions, watch your fantasies during the day, your daydreams, and you will find that they center around this miserable, postulated, permanent entity, I am I. The Mephistopheles of our lives. Alright? Watch that. Mindfulness, therefore. Be very well aware of what you are doing, feeling, thinking, speaking. Every gesture, every activity, every output of energy, every reaction, every fear, everything, be aware of it. But be just aware of it. Watch it. With no judgments. And what I mean by that is not exactly no judgments. you see the thing for what it is. And in seeing the thing for what it is, a judgment is implied, unquestionably. But with that seeing the thing for what it is, there is neither condemnation nor approval. If you condemn, there is an outflow of aversion. You're in a state of conflict that way. You are bound by your own aversion. If you approve and desire to have it or increase it, etc., you experience attachment. And to whatsoever you are attached, whether it be good or bad, makes no difference whatsoever. You are that much conditioned. There is no freedom. You cannot let the becoming process flow past naturally, spontaneously, freely. Attachment and aversion are the two devils on either side which bind you in chains. So, be mindful throughout the day. That is the most important aspect of meditation for people like ourselves living in the world. It's the most important, and it persists right through one's life. There is no end to that. The second aspect is what I would call discursive meditation. That is to say, you decide to sit in meditation and go through a meditation, as you call it. This is just musing. This is a verbal ritual you go through. Look very carefully, examine very carefully what you do when you meditate, as you say, or when you pray, as you say. Use whichever word you like. Use the terms of Christian mysticism, if you wish, prayer, contemplation, the different prayers of quiet, of recollection, of union, and purgation, and all the rest of it, the origins, as they are called. Look at them. They're all the same thing in reality. Or look at this process of meditation. You go through a verbal ritual. Now, in going through a verbal ritual, what precisely have you done? You have circled round in your own limited sphere of thoughts, feelings, ideas, conceptions, all of which, again, are just temporal, changing, limited forms, subject to death. And they are not truth. They are photographs purporting to be photographs of reality. In an ordinary photograph, it's a real picture of the actual fellow. You can recognize the actual fellow. But when you take all these photographs of reality in your own minds, and one day the flash of enlightenment comes, it absolutely burns out, completely burns out all the photographs and you of in the mind, and you will see that they were all false. You wake up to the fact they were all false. And it is this which we worship and use as an anchor for our spiritual welfare, for our psychological health, and all the rest of it. Forgive me if I am absolutely too iconoclastic, too radical and drastic, but it's no good playing with truth. It's better to be healed now than to postpone the healing, because, you know, the operation is rather a little bit painful. And for God's sake, don't look for any anesthetics in this spiritual operation. That's the worst thing you can do. Now, so in the discursive meditation, we go through a verbal ritual, which gives us a nice feeling, which liberates a certain amount of psychical energy for what we call good within the ambivalent sphere. It is not the good. It is not supreme virtue at all. You don't know what virtue is in the real sense. And the virtuous life in the real sense is the only life which the real human, the full human, lives. Otherwise, we are all subhuman. Now, this is a necessary stage, if only to discover that it is something which you have to get out of. It was all the pleasant part of the kindergarten where the teacher cajoles us and fools us into getting us to do the work that he wants us to do. You see, this is not ourselves with our creative energies up and about and wanting to let them express themselves, you see. It's not that. Then there comes the point when you can be still and silent in the real sense without being asleep. It's only in deep dreamless slumber that any one of us is really still and silent. But that being a state of unconsciousness is of no use to us in our daily life, apart from the fact that that dreamless slumber recharges and revitalizes the whole psychophysical organism. That is its only value for us. But when in the waking state you let all the sense functioning, all the incessant flow of useless chatter in the brain come to rest, when the sense functions and the discursive thought and speech are completely pacified, then this something inward is allowed to wake up and function. Then starts pure meditation, in which there is no thought, no movement of the thinking process. Nothing that we know of down here is at work. The immeasurable, the dimensionless, the absolute, in which all this which is not absolute is subsumed and held in suspense, so to say. See, that comes into action and play, and then you are in real meditation, which implied the complete stoppage, the stopping of this terrible traffic inside the brain, the stoppage of that, and the state of utter peace and quiet, in which the unknown functions through you and you don't know it. You don't know that it is functioning. As I said earlier, later on, if you're gifted that way, the brain will produce a thought structure and a verbal formulation. Now that is the state of meditation, which is the state of communion, of pure communion. This is the Unio Mystica, if you like, the peak point of the religious life. And that is meditation. And it is in that kind of meditation that all that I said earlier, especially with regard to this being in tune with the creative pulse of life, which is a discontinuous pulse, and it is a pulse not of life-death. The Kabbalah and the Veda, both, which are the original roots of all the religious traditions of the great religions of the world and the peoples of Asia and of Europe and America. You see, they put it as the pulse of life-death. I prefer to cut out the word death altogether because its denotation as well as all its connotations in our mind are inadequate and misleading. I prefer to put it this way. It is the creative pulse of life, other life. The creative pulse which brings into being finitude and multitudinous variety of particulars on the one hand, and the other aspect of that pulse is the infinite, the one unitary non-being. It is that creative pulse. See, so in deep meditation, you get into tune with this thing. And when you get into tune with this thing, your whole life is utterly transformed. You don't have to go about doing good in the world then. In fact, you will have learnt the wisdom of being quiet and doing nothing. But through you, because your own mind is empty, because you are utterly purified, because you are utterly still and silent, capable of absorbing that energy of a nature which would shatter any ordinary human being. You absorb it and it flows out of you freely. If you like to use a theistic term, God. I like to use the term transcendence because it implies both the personal, the impersonal, and the transpersonal. You see, transcendence flows into you and out of you quite freely. Don't ask what good it will do. The question is asked by the mind that is ignorant, by the mind that is seeking some result. And you can only seek a result for your own self, or your own self identified with other selves, which is only a glorification of your own self. So have no illusions whatever. Be happy, be glad, be ecstatic if you like, that illusions disappear and that truth is there. And the truth will bring you both pleasure and pain, joy and sorrow. Take it. It's the gift of the transcendence to you. And learn out of it. And you will be one example of human fruition through whom eternal God finds expression.